is EM Cases, EM Quick Hits Podcast. Quick, let's get on with it. EM Cases is part of SHREMI, the Schwartz-Reisman Emergency Medicine Institute. That's the nonprofit organization dedicated to improving EM care through high-quality research and education. The opinions expressed on this podcast are intended for general information and educational purposes only and should not be used to diagnose, treat, or prevent any medical condition, nor should they be used as a substitute for medical advice from a qualified practicing physician. Unless stated otherwise, the opinions expressed by the hosts or guests are made in their individual capacity, not on behalf of the Institute nor Medicine Cases. This episode is brought to you by Easy Recess, the resuscitation assistant. This amazing app has drug dosing, equipment size calculation, treatment algorithms, all in under 3 clicks. Rapid access to life-saving critical info in a user-friendly interface. Try the app for free with the promo code EMCases or visit easyrecess.com/EMCases. That's easyrecess.com/EMCases. First up is our Quick Hits EBM specialist, Justin Morgenstern, who's going to talk about nitroglycerin in SCAPE. So that's IV nitro dosing in sympathetic crashing acute pulmonary edema, the sick CHF patient with lots of blood pressure to work with.
The report from EMS was that the patient was fine an hour ago. Now they look like they're going to die. Sats in the 70s, blood pressure above 200, drowning in pulmonary edema crackles everywhere, working very hard to breathe. This is sympathetic crashing pulmonary edema, or SCAPE. And the question is, are you using the right dose of nitroglycerin? Because I think most people probably aren't. Most people in medicine have probably been underdosing nitroglycerin. In residency, I was taught, you know, you start a nitro grip at something like 10 or maybe 20 mics a minute. 50 was considered very high dose. Now, since I was in residency, practice has changed somewhat, and I've seen people using higher and maybe appropriately dosed nitroglycerin. There's been a few observational studies suggesting safety at higher doses, and personally, I have been using higher doses, but this year, we had our first RCT. It's an open-label, single-center RCT. It's small. It only had 52 patients, but despite that, it's the best data that we have because it's our only RCT. So they enrolled sick SCAPE patients. They had to have hypoxia, hypertension, respiratory distress, and then they randomized them to either high or low dose nitroglycerin. High dose was an IV bolus between 600 and 1,000 micrograms, followed by an infusion that started at 100 micrograms a minute. And that was compared to basically usual care, which was an infusion that was started at 20 to 40 micrograms a minute, and there was no bolus. There was a hard max. You couldn't go above 250 mics a minute in the low dose group. All patients in both groups were started on BiPAP, which makes sense. And the headline news, results were dramatically better with high-dose nitroglycerin. Resolution of symptoms by 6 hours was 65% versus 12%. So that's an absolute benefit of 53%, or a number needed to treat of almost 2. Intubation was 19% versus 4%. Everything was better. Admission rates, length of stay, major adverse cardiac events, everything. In terms of safety, there was no hypotension in either group. There were some headaches, but there were actually more of those in the low-dose group. So overall, this looks incredible, although with small single-center unblinded trials, I do always worry about, is it too good to be true? So let's talk about some limitations. Again, this is a small single-center unblinded trial. It's the best evidence that we have to date, but that doesn't mean that it's incredible evidence. Unblinded trials always worry me. Most of the outcomes here probably seem pretty objective, but even objective outcomes can be biased. Everybody in emergency medicine has, for example, run a blood pressure, thought to themselves, that doesn't seem right, and run it again. And then you only write down the number that fits with what you expected. So in an unblinded trial, those small differences can really have a big difference in terms of the outcomes of the trial. I think the other big nuance with this trial is generalizability. These patients don't look a lot like my patients. Despite being relatively young, the mean age here was in the 40s. 70% had chronic renal failure, basically 100% had baseline hypertension. And on top of it, you know, it's somewhat remarkable to me how few of these patients felt better by 6 hours, even in the high dose group. It was only 65%, but in my practice, high-dose nitro and BiPAP cures all of these patients by 2 or 3 hours, like every time. 19% of the control group here was intubated. In my career, I have never once intubated a SCAPE patient. So these patients, and maybe the standard practices at this hospital, are just different than what I'm used to, and so the results may not generalize. And maybe this is why so many people in North America have gotten away with using small or minuscule doses of nitro for all this time. Maybe our patients just aren't that sick. So, as a single study, you know, it's not completely convincing. It's single center. It's unblinded. But a huge part of evidence-based medicine is pretest probability and asking, how does this fit with the rest of the science? And there's already been a fair amount of evidence that show good outcomes with high-dose nitroglycerin. For example, Wilson 2016, they were giving 2 milligram or 2,000 microgram IV push doses, and those high doses were associated with lower rates of ICU use, and the hypotension rate was only 2%. Matthew 2021 published a cohort of only 25 patients, but they were receiving IV boluses between 600 and 1,000 micrograms with no complications. Houseman 2023 describes a cohort of 67 patients with IV infusions all started higher than 100 micrograms an hour. There was a 4% rate of hypotension. So, you know, not very high at all. And given that most hypotension is short-lived and easily resolved by just turning down the drip, it seems pretty safe. So despite the fact that this is just a small single-center RCT, this new paper is the best study that we have, and it nicely meshes with all of the available data. I think this is practice changing if you're currently using low-dose nitro. Practically speaking, I still often do the bolus dose sublingually, just because it takes nurses time to get the IV medicine drawn up, and it gives me something to do while the nurses are getting the IV nitroglycerin and the RT is getting the BiPAP ready. Don't forget, BiPAP is the other essential ingredient here. So I usually just start with 2 or 3 sprays, which is 800 to 1200 micrograms under the tongue, before putting on that BiPAP mask. And because I already have given that bolus, I usually just start with an infusion, and I start my infusion at 100 mics a minute, but I'm ready to titrate up or down. Now, if the IV is ready right away, I'm very happy to give an IV bolus, and based on this data, I would give an IV bolus between 500 and 1,000 micrograms, and then I would start with that same infusion of 100 micrograms a minute. But I'd love to hear your thoughts. Do you disagree? Do you have other tips for managing these SCAPE patients? I'd love to see some debate on the EM Cases comments section. Until next time, bye-bye.
Yep, I also start with a few sublingual sprays, have RT throw on the BiPAP, and start an IV infusion of nitro at 50 to 100 micrograms per minute, depending on the patient's blood pressure and my blood pressure. Thank you very much, Dr. Morgenstern. So last December, I ran online podcast camp, the boutique course on medical podcast production, and there were these two incredible attendees, EM docs from Ireland, who submitted such an excellent podcast for the Pod Wars at the end of the course that I invited them to contribute to EM Quick Hits. This is Dr. Leah Flanagan and Dr. Liam Lowry of the Case Report podcast. Here we go.
Dr. Andrew, or Andy Neal, is a consultant in emergency medicine or intensive care in the Mater University Hospital in Dublin. And I absolutely cannot wait to hear about what he has to say about one of the most rising and controversial topics in emergency medicine, resuscitative endovascular balloon occlusion of the aorta, or REBOA. So it's a pleasure to have you with us. And I hear you have to share a little bit of healthy skepticism about the topic. So I thought you might start off by kind of giving us a little bit about the background and what is REBOA.
Sure, sure thing. So thanks very much for the invite again. So what is it? It's an endovascular technique used to control or stop bleeding in a temporary fashion to allow you to buy you time to get the definitive hemorrhage control. So you're placing a catheter within the aorta from the femoral artery. And when you get it in the right place in the aorta, you blow up a balloon like the balloon on the end of a urinary catheter, and you occlude the entire aorta with that balloon, and you're going to prevent bleeding that is distal to that point. You're also going to occlude any blood flow distal to that point as well, which is the downsides. So for example, let's say you have a mangled pelvis, you're bleeding to death from some obscure branch of an iliac artery deep in the pelvis. You might use REBOA to occlude aortic blood flow altogether to buy some time to get some blood products in to get to your definitive management. In this case, it's probably going to be IR to coil that vessel. It has to be temporizing. That's a key point. It's a temporizing thing to get you to definitive hemorrhage control. And if you don't have a plan for definitive hemorrhage control, why are you doing the REBOA? The most obvious downside, if I've mentioned, is that you're effectively using REBOA like a tourniquet for the entire blood supply to the lower half of the body. doesn't seem like a wonderful idea. So the same way you can only put tourniquets on limbs for, you have to be careful for lengths of time and things like that. You're going to cause ischemia. You're going to cause trouble. You're going to run into the same trouble if you do that with Reboa. Now, there's lots of other complications as well, but that seems to be the obvious downside.
So I suppose you're kind of saying that it's definitely a temporizing measure. It's nothing permanent. It's just to get you to your definitive management.
Yeah.
And you're looking to occlude bleeding distal to that site. So it depends on where you look to inflate it. Is there a certain amount of time that you can keep them inflated for, or?
Sure, that all depends, I suppose, doesn't it? Depends on blood flow and things like that. Common cutoff is 30 minutes is what's quoted. But again, it all depends. You have this thing where people put it up for a little bit of time. They get a bit of blood product in, then they let it down again. Just let a little bit of blood flow go in, then they blow it up again. So that is a described technique of how people could do this. But in reality, it depends how shocked you are. The patient may already be very malperfused in their lower half of their body because they've taken out some significant blood vessel down there. Adding then an iatrogenic occlusion may cause further ischemia. So the 30-minute thing is clearly somewhat arbitrary, and obviously the minimal amount of time as possible.
Fair enough. And then where did this all come from? It became such a hot topic out of nowhere, and obviously it must have some indications or some role to play, but where did it come from?
Not a new idea. First reports back in the 50s during the Korean War, apparently. But it seems to be that it's a recent improvement and explosion in endovascular technology, interventional radiology, all those endovascular treatments, now that we have them available, it's reared its head as a potentially useful option. And I think there's probably two reasons why it's got so much attention. While I'm happy to describe myself as a skeptic for this, I do think it probably does have a role. I think it'll be quite a small role, and it's unclear as yet who'll benefit. But it does seem like something that can be useful. I mean, that idea of being able to temporize bleeding, get your blood pressure up enough to preserve life, get a few blood products in while you're heading to definitive management seems like a brilliant idea. Why would you not want to do that? But I think the second reason it's got so much attention, and probably the dominant reason, is that we all like new, shiny, fancy things. You probably know the distracted boyfriend meme. When you've got this guy who's walking with his girlfriend. He's looking over his shoulder at some other woman while the girlfriend looks horrified. I use that meme in so many talks. I feel like many of us are like getting distracted by the shiny new Reboa looking over his shoulder, and we're neglecting the basics of high quality resuscitation and all the systems of care, which I think is likely where the improved outcome in trauma systems is, rather than shiny new things like Reboa.
And then I suppose, who is getting this shiny new thing? Like, what are the indications for it? When are people thinking of using it? I know it's not widely used but
who would you think about it in? Yeah, it's hard to say what the indication is, because as you'll hear later on, no one has actually been able to prove that it works as yet. So for example, in the UK Reboa trial, the only randomized trial we have so far, the phrase used for their inclusion was confirmed or suspected life-threatening torso hemorrhage, which was deemed to be amenable to adjunctive treatment with Reboa. So basically, you could get in the trial if you were thought you had life-threatening hemorrhage and someone thought Reboa might be useful. And obviously, that's completely subjective, dependent on the skills of the trauma team involved. And so it's a very broad and a very pragmatic definition, which is fine for the trial. The way I kind of see it is filling a niche that's similar to resuscitative thoracotomy. And somehow that's how it gets sold or described, where you have refractory hemorrhagic shock and the patient is either already arrested or is about to arrest despite maximal resuscitation. So for example, in a resuscitated thoracotomy, one of the things that you can do, the most useful thing by far is, of course, is draining a tamponade. That's the thing that will save lives. Once you've done all those things, there's lots of other stuff you can do in the chest that might help your resuscitation. And one of those things is occluding the descending aorta. So you get your hand in, you press in the descending aorta. And by doing this, you might be able to keep the heart beating. So maintain perfusion to the coronaries, maintain perfusion to the brain, while you figure out how to stop the bleeding. You can see the obvious attraction that something like Reboa might fill that same niche, but it's an order of magnitude less invasive to be able to put a catheter in through the femoral artery rather than opening the chest and putting a fist or a retractor or on a descending aorta.
You can definitely see why it's quite attractive, so fair enough. And then complications-wise, you kind of briefly touched on these earlier on with things like ischemia. What are the complications of Reboa, potential harms?
I suppose there's lots. There's procedural risk from arterial access. So this is not necessarily straightforward, and people are not used to putting things like sheaths into arteries. I think many of us are comfortable putting in a very kind of an 18 gauge or a 20 gauge femoral arterial line where there's no dilation steps or anything like that. But common sheaths would be 12 French in size, so 4 millimeters, pretty big. There's a 7 French version available. there's often, I think, maybe an overconfidence that comes from placing femoral arterial lines. It makes you think, I've put in a couple of femoral arterial lines, it can't be harder than that, and you can put this in a peri-arrest situation, you think it'll be straightforward. I think that's probably overly optimistic. There is a big risk, as I mentioned, from ischemia to important organs. So remember, a tourniquet to the lower body, the longer it's up, the more likely you are to be dealing with something like dead gut down the line, or a severe reperfusion injury when you let the balloon down, causing a hyperkalemic cardiac arrest when the balloon comes down. I think probably more importantly, the risk from doing this is that you do it in someone where you didn't necessarily need to do it. And indeed, you're doing Reboa instead of doing more important things in the resuscitation. So it's an opportunity cost. This is why the evidence base and the indication needs to be better. There are plenty of people with life-threatening bleeding who are peri-arrest who can be temporized with a high-quality blood product resuscitation, a pelvic binder, or a swift transfer to endovascular expertise in IR. The risk, a bigger risk, I think, here at the minute, because we don't know who to use it on, is playing with a new toy because it's shiny and new and taking ages doing that, and we're missing the basics, and we're exposing patients to harm while missing all that important resuscitation.
So some kind of common complications or possible complications are things like ischemia distally, reperfusion injuries, hyperkalemic arrests, and putting into the patients that don't necessarily need it, or being a little bit overconfident in the way that we do that because we're used to femoral access in these patients. So absolutely needs a little bit more study on it. You mentioned that although it hasn't been implemented into our practice in Ireland, and may never be for that matter, is the insertion complicated, or how does the actual procedure work, and would it be considered a surgical procedure, or is it suitable for the pre-hospital scene or the department?
So like so many things, it's a Seldinger technique. And again, you can look at it two ways. One, you can view it as a fancy arterial line. You get arterial access with needle and wire. This is not foreign to anybody who's done a central line, for example. So you can look at it that way. You dilate it up like a central line. You pass the sheath thing, which is again a bit like a central line, into an artery, and then you pass a catheter up the sheath. Once you get that catheter tip to the right position where you want it to be, you blow up a balloon and occlude the aorta. And in many ways, when you say it like that in a casual voice, it sounds easy peasy. But I think this is a touch naive, and I think you'll land yourself in a lot of bother if you assume that the femoral art line you did during a cardiac arrest last week means that you're now ready to do a Reboa insertion. So maybe a more nuanced view of the procedure says this is a challenging high-risk procedure where you've got, let's say you're going to have significant human factor challenges. So there's going to be lots of people in this scenario. There's going to be lots of drama. You're going to have equipment challenges. So again, because no one's doing this very much, you may well not be familiar with the sheath or the wire. It's not your standard central line kit. And then there's going to be the actual technical procedural challenges where you're doing this in a patient bleeding to death who will not have a nice, large, pulsatile, easy-to-hit femoral with a good kind of flashback in your needle where it's squirting across the bed. You might get a wee dribble. You might think you're in a vein when you're actually in the artery. Especially when you're doing this on someone who's got a pelvic binder on, who's probably not tubed, because if you tube these people, they'll probably die. So they may still be a little bit of writhing and wriggling in the bed. So there's going to be lots and lots of challenges to do this, and not just to do it as a Hail Mary, but to do this reliably and well without interrupting the flow of this patient to where, remember, where they need to be, which is definitive hemorrhage control. And Reboa is not definitive hemorrhage control. Other things, without an image intensifier, you'd be worried about the wire and balloon position. So just because you've got a wire 50 centimeters into the aorta doesn't mean it's going to be where you expect it to be. When these things are done in IR, they're doing it with live image intensifier guidance. Your wire may be in a side branch in some wee lumbar vessel somewhere. And if you then shove your catheter in that and blow up a 30cc balloon, you're going to rupture a vessel. So it's impossible to see how you could deliver this reliably and safely without either pausing to take a chest x-ray to check where your wire position is before you deliver your balloon over the top of that. So I think x-ray confirmation, potentially TOE confirmation, you're going to cause all kinds of new bleeding. You could see how in a really highly functioning trauma team who do trauma day in and day out, and they have dedicated time for simulation and planning. They've got their trolleys prepared for Reboa, all this kind of stuff. They've got all their action car, all that kind of stuff that you see at really high level places. You could see how this could be delivered in an efficient and safe practice, but I think in Ireland we are not at that stage yet. And I think that's probably the same for pre-hospital. Now, this has been done pre-hospital. It's reported. It is a thing that happens. But again, that's a bit like going to the moon. Yes, we have, human beings have flown to the moon. Yes, we have landed on it. But that doesn't mean you can go out and do it tomorrow. And in a system like ours, I think we need to take baby steps. We need to walk before we could run. I think that's probably where we're at.
And it's tricky because even when you mentioned there about, you know, you have a high functioning trauma team, maybe it's possible for them, or a high functioning trauma center, But like in those situations, you'd hope that we'd have maybe 24 access to a polytrauma theater, and that these patients may be suitable actually to just do, as you said earlier on, appropriate resuscitation and straight to theater, rather than spending 10 minutes doing this procedure downstairs for nothing. So fair enough. Let's get to the nitty gritty then. So this is all super interesting, but the reality of this is really different, as you mentioned before. You mentioned the UK REBOA trial, and there was a few small kind of studies before that as well. What is the evidence around REBOA at the moment?
So the initial one was multiple reports of observational data, and there's actually a 2021 systematic review by Castellini et al. So they looked at all the available observational data in about 10 studies. And again, they looked at a couple of comparison groups. And you have to remember, you're always going to be limited in observational data because you don't have a randomization process. So you're going to be potential bias introduced there. And they looked at all those studies, put them together, and they suggested that REBOA was better than a resuscitative thoracotomy, but not necessarily better than doing nothing. Which is like, oh, well, so that means we should be doing neither, would be my conclusion from that. No, that's just observational data. And so there's no kind of clear kind of benefit from that. The main thing probably worth talking about is the UK REBOA trial. Not that it's by no means the final word on this. We don't have large amounts of high-quality evidence available to us. People are still working on that. It's not like the massive cardiology trials where you get a 20,000-patient RCT and you're able to show a 1% mortality improvement. The UK REBOA trial was published last year and was a big step in the research as the first randomized trial. And you can read it a few different ways. So one very simple take on it would be, it was a negative trial where REBOA was unhelpful and potentially harmful. Therefore, we shouldn't do it. And in many sense, that's undoubtedly a true statement, but it's a touch inadequate to describe everything that happened in the trial. It was a small pragmatic trial, about 90 patients or so, done in 16 centres across the UK, though 3 centres really did all the work. In the group who got REBOA, so about 45 patients who got a REBOA catheter placed, for some reason only 40% of them ever had the balloon inflated. And that may have been because they were too well and they didn't need it inflated, or something else had happened. It's not entirely clear from a straightforward read as to why that wasn't happening. There also seems to be quite a big gap between the intervention, REBOA, and then the definitive bleeding control. So what that suggests is that the systems where this was being done weren't well enough set up to ensure the bleeding control could be, like definitive bleeding control, could be delivered in a timely fashion. Perhaps the skill set wasn't there. Perhaps the systems in place weren't there. I don't know. Again, that's not what the study tells you. So in other words, you could definitely make the argument, and many people have, that this is more of a trial of REBOA done too broadly and perhaps done suboptimally. And it's hardly surprising that it was a negative trial. So it's not necessarily a failure of REBOA. It's a failure of the appropriate application of REBOA in a context of a trauma system that delivers definitive hemorrhage management. And again, several people have taken that, and I think it's a very reasonable thing to say. Which is why, I mean, while this is a negative trial, I don't think it's ready for any of us to roll out within our trauma centre, certainly within Ireland. There's still plenty of room and plenty of time for people to find a trial with the right cohort, with the right systems of care, to show that this is a useful thing to be done. But so far, we do not have obvious evidence in its support.
And would that be possible for a larger system like the US or Canada then, if you had, I suppose is the point that you're kind of making, that we need people who are trained in this, that are proficient in it, that know the right indications, the patients that do need it, and then do it over, it's very hard to do this, but like 5-10 years and get enough patients. Is that what you're kind of looking for rather than...
Again, where that to be done, I mean, it's identifying where you go next. If you do a very broad cohort, do you do your next trial on a much more select cohort? Do you restrict the people to do this who are people who are as true expertise, inverted commas, as you can be? It's clear, however, that this isn't an easily deliverable thing. There's a nice, again, Kareem Brohe, if you ever read Kareem Brohe on Twitter, he's just such a legend, that man. So he's a vascular surgeon. He led the London Trauma Network, and he's done a lot of good stuff, and he's a lot of very wise words. And the people are talking about how REBOA, oh, it's just like a fancy arterial catheter. It's not that hard. And he was like, look, I'm a trauma and vascular surgeon for 20 years. This is my job and all I do. And I have failed to get REBOA in several occasions. Like, this is not that easy a thing to do. And that came out in the trial, in that there was, I think, a 15% failure to actually be able to deliver the device into the femoral artery, something around that. So even in people who have skill sets, this is not always going to be delivered. And obviously that success rate is going to go way, way down on someone who does it occasionally. And because it's always going to be an occasional procedure, it's hard to see how you build up the skill sets to get really good at that. I think just the biggest thing is you have to really focus on the systems of care surrounding that bleeding patient And I think introducing Reboa, where you haven't optimized every other step of the care, introducing Reboa is not going to be a panacea. It's not going to fix things.
And I think you've absolutely ruined that meme of the boyfriend there, because every time I see it, I'm just going to think it's Reboa.
Well, if you really want, it works really well for competitive antagonism, for naloxone or any kind of drug antidote you want. It works. It's just, pharmacologically, it's just a little chef's kiss emoji. It's a meme. You can use it for everything.
I only see it in medical terms.
Now, yeah, that's all I see it now. Yeah.
Andy, that's super. Thank you so much. I feel like you've cleared a lot of that up. It's a super complex topic, actually, but you've broken it down really nicely. And I suppose we're just not there yet. It's good to understand it. It's something that's really widely debated. And so being able to kind of contribute a little bit and understand what's out there is really important. And we'll obviously link everything that you've talked about in the show notes. And I hope you'll join us back again.
Yeah, we'll be glad to. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Andy.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Let's just say that you had an extra hour in your day. What would you do with that hour? Exercise, read, hang out with family or friends, take a nap? The best way to work that special thing into your busy schedule is to know what's important to you and make that thing a priority. Talk therapy can help you figure out what matters to you most so that you can do more of it. So much of our time is living in our own heads. Getting feedback from a therapist and helping you reflect on all that stuff in your head from an objective expert's perspective, that is what empowers you to be the best version of yourself. If you ever thought about giving therapy a try, BetterHelp is convenient and flexible, easy to slide into your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/emcases today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/EMcases. All right, next up, we've got Britt Long on the workup of diverticulitis. Take it away, Britt.
Diverticulosis is common, as are the complications. Chances are you've seen a patient with diverticulitis on one of your last shifts. There have been a number of studies and guidelines released in the last couple years on the evaluation and management of diverticulitis. On today's Quick Hits episode, we're going to dive into the workup of diverticulitis. Let's start with the presentation. Tenderness in the left lower quadrant has a positive likelihood ratio of over 10 with a negative likelihood ratio of around 0.7. A history of pain in the left lower quadrant isn't as great. It has a positive likelihood ratio of 3.3. A change in bowel habits like diarrhea or constipation can be present in up to half of cases, and nausea and vomiting may or may not be present. Patients can have a fever, but you shouldn't find any evidence of peritonitis in uncomplicated cases. When we look at labs, they're not going to make or break the diagnosis. The white blood cell count is elevated in about half of cases. CRP has also been studied either alone or in combination with white blood cell count and the history and exam. The greater the elevation in CRP, the higher the likelihood of more severe disease or a complication. The issue here with labs, though, is that they're not definitive and you can't use them to exclude the diagnosis. That leaves us with imaging, and this is where I want to spend the majority of the discussion. The first-line test is CT with IV contrast. This has a sensitivity and specificity over 95%. But the big question is, when do we need a CT? What's wrong with just using your history and exam for the diagnosis? Thankfully, there are a number of organizations with guidelines that look at this exact question. All of the guidelines recommend CT as the first-line imaging test in the majority of patients. This is mainly because it can confirm the diagnosis and it can look for complications. However, there are some small differences in the guidelines, and we're going to dive into these. Let's start with the World Society of Emergency Surgery Guidelines, published in 2020. This guideline recommends imaging with CT for definitive diagnosis, and they suggest against using history and exam alone. Next are the 2020 American Society of Colon and Rectal Surgeons Clinical Practice Guidelines. These state that we should use history, exam, and labs in the evaluation, but they recommend CT as the best means of diagnosing diverticulitis. They also recommend it for evaluating disease severity, and it helps determine the appropriate treatment. Our next set comes from the American Gastroenterological Association 2021 guidelines. These recommend using CT to confirm the diagnosis if there's been no prior imaging confirmation, and they also recommend CT to evaluate for potential complications in patients with severe presentations. They also recommend it in patients who fail to improve with therapy, are immunocompromised, or who have had multiple recurrences and are contemplating prophylactic surgery in order to confirm the diagnosis and look at the locations of the disease. The next two guidelines are a little bit different. The American College of Radiology appropriateness criteria are one of the best resources available for imaging. They say that if there's left lower quadrant pain and you're not sure of the diagnosis, then start with CT with IV contrast. If you think the patient has diverticulitis, the recommendations actually state that you may not need imaging in certain patients with typical symptoms of diverticulitis, they've had a prior history with similar symptoms, and there's no evidence of complication. However, the guidelines do state there's been a trend towards imaging with CT to confirm the diagnosis, evaluate the extent of disease, and detect complications before deciding on therapy. This is mainly because of the complications that can occur, and there's also that risk of misdiagnosis in anywhere between 25 to 75% of cases. Finally, we have the clinical guidelines from the American College of Physicians published in 2022. They recommend ordering CT if there's diagnostic uncertainty. However, if you have a patient with left lower quadrant pain and you're suspecting acute diverticulitis, they recommend starting with history, exam, and labs, and then potentially stopping there. Now, if you're uncertain of the diagnosis, then get the CT. They also recommend CT if there's any concern for complication, if they're immunosuppressed, or they're critically ill. So, with all of these guideline recommendations, where does that leave us? History and exam are the cornerstone of our evaluation, but CT is a major player. Now, I'm not saying we need to CT every patient with suspected diverticulitis, and I think you're backed up by the literature here and the guidelines if you don't get a CT. If diverticulitis is the top condition on the differential and you have a well-appearing patient, their symptoms are controlled and they're PO tolerant, they're not immunosuppressed, there's no evidence of sepsis, there's no significant comorbidities, and they've had a prior episode of uncomplicated diverticulitis that presented in a similar fashion, you can potentially discharge the patient with close follow-up and strict return precautions without the CT using shared decision-making. If they can't be seen by their provider, have them return in 24 to 48 hours for a recheck. If you're unsure or the patient is sick or immunocompromised, you're worried about a complication, then get the CT. Hopefully you feel a little bit better about the evaluation for diverticulitis. Stay tuned for our next episode where we'll look at antibiotics for uncomplicated diverticulitis.
Thank you so much, Dr. Long. You know, when it comes to CT imaging, a similar thought process applies to renal colic, where we do sometimes have the option of not ordering any imaging or ordering an ultrasound which will miss tiny stones, but those aren't the ones that we really need to know about. And I wonder if the same could be said for diverticulitis. Ultrasound for diverticulitis, anyone? All right, next up, we have the mighty return of Tahara Bate for a Best of University of Toronto EM Quick Hit. I won't give the case away. And now for the Best of University of Toronto Emergency Medicine.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm so thrilled to be back and sharing another great case with you here on QI Corner. It's a great example of a back-to-basics case that I'm really excited about, so let's get into it. Our scene is the busy downtown site of the Janus General Hospital, and it's about 3 a.m. on a Wednesday. You're a few hours into a typically busy night shift. Your resident has been seeing patients fairly independently, and she comes to present her next case. I have a 70-year-old woman who presents with acute vision loss in her right eye. She went to bed well, woke up just after midnight, and realized she couldn't see out of that eye. Her neuro and ophtho review of systems is negative, and her physical exam is fine. There's no focal deficits, cranial nerve palsies, normal IOP. Pupils are quite small, but I'm pretty sure they're reactive. She can't see anything out of that right eye, though, I confirmed. Her past history is significant for breast cancer, in remission, as well as hypertension and dyslipidemia. I went ahead and got some neuroimaging, and there's no evidence of CVA on the CTA. However, it looks like there are some large extra-axial soft tissue densities that are anterior to the frontal lobe, and radiology is querying potential metastatic deposits. They also suggest a neurosurge consult, which I went ahead and entered. All right, sounds good, you say. Let me know what neurosurge says. The rest of the night proceeds as per usual, that is to say tons of volume, lots of acuity, and before you know it, it's 4 hours later, just after 7 a.m. You run the board with your resident and realize you never heard anything else from neurosurgery. You repage, and it turns out the team is still scrubbed and has been for the last several hours. Given the time and the delay, after hearing the case via speakerphone, the neurosurgeon suggests an MR is needed, and they're very happy to see the patient after the scan. You order the MR, hand over the case to your daytime colleague, do some quick feedback with your learner, go home, and collapse into bed. What did you miss? While you are asleep at home, this patient continues to wait in the ED, gets her MRI done around noon. Unfortunately, it demonstrates a number of extra-axial and bony lesions, which is consistent with widespread metastasis. Your colleague calls back the neurosurgery team, as was the plan, but here's where things get interesting. There's a new neurosurgeon on for the day, and when he reviews the images along with the clinical story, it just doesn't make sense. There's no mechanism he can think of by which these lesions can cause this localization of symptoms. Your colleague reassesses the patient and gathers the same history. That history being acute, painless, monocular vision loss. Ophthalmology is urgently consulted, and the patient is diagnosed with a CRAO, a central retinal artery occlusion. And unfortunately, they do not ultimately recover vision in that eye. So you and your learner missed a CRAO, but the important part, as always, is why. Now, if you've heard my segment before, you know that I love to talk about how all these complexities external to our medical decision-making process can influence our cases. And it's true that it's often the interaction between these factors, rather than any one element in isolation, that produces a given outcome. But that doesn't mean we can forget about the potential cognitive errors embedded in our decision-making process. And that's why I thought this case was really interesting to share. If we use our normal framework for analyzing these cases, which is breaking them down according to system, provider, and patient factors, then sure, we can identify some contributing issues. Issues like this being an oncology patient with a type of cancer well known for brain mets who presented with new mets on imaging, or the fact that the neurosurgery opinion was given under less than ideal circumstances, which could be its whole other talk. But what this case really turns on, in my opinion, is the premature closure of the initial attending on evidence of metastatic disease. And it is such a good example of why we can sometimes get in trouble with what's called type 1 thinking or heuristics, which is in contrast to the more analytical type 2 thinking. Our heuristic, or pattern recognition, whatever you want to call it, for this case was cancer patient plus brain mets explains neurosymptoms. Another classic is cancer patient plus shortness of breath equals PE, except when it's possible that it's from a pericardial effusion, which was a sim case in residency that I have never forgotten. Now, we aren't saying type 1 thinking is bad. I mean, pattern recognition could reasonably be considered the diagnostic backbone of our specialty. But we do have to watch for it. Now, the topic of cognitive errors is absolutely fascinating, but not one we can do a lot of justice to here. If you're interested, I'd refer you to EM cases number 11 and 75, and you can go from there. Tons of resources listed. But to bring it back to our case, what are some tangible takeaways? Number one is ask yourself, does the diagnosis match the one-liner? You'll notice how I emphasized in this case that it's actually a presentation of an acute, painless monocular vision loss. And it was that framing that led to the eventual diagnosis. Centering the patient presentation around the one-liner forces you into a particular diagnostic schema or framework. And we all do this to some extent, especially for those cases that don't make sense. Consider adding that final mental check when you're finishing up with a patient, especially at high-risk times like overnight, high volumes, or towards the end of your shift when we know errors increase. Takeaway number two, don't forget that CRAO is a time-sensitive diagnosis. CRAO is essentially a stroke of the eye, except it's a stroke that you can't see on neuroimaging. And while these patients might have an afferent pupillary defect, apart from the visual deficit, unless you are really good with fundoscopy, there really isn't a lot to find on exam. In this particular case, the second staff did see an APD, but it was subtle. These patients need urgent opto assessment. Early intervention can, in some cases, lead to some improvement in vision. So, in summary, watch out for that diagnosis of central retinal artery occlusion. And spend some time thinking about how you use type 1 thinking in your practice. And ask yourself, are there places where you might be able to build some safety checks into your clinical routine? So until next time, remember that a mistake is never just a mistake.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Dr. Bate. Great to have you back. And now a word from one of our sponsors, EZ Recess, the resuscitation assistant. Did you know that Easy Recess is brought to you by a nonprofit organization dedicated to improving care in resuscitation? This means that every dollar from your subscription goes to improving Easy Recess. But not only that, thanks to your contributions, Easy Recess can be made affordable for healthcare workers in developing countries so that they can also deliver the best care possible to their patients. If you want to help them in their mission, download Easy Recess and use promo code EMCases to get your first 2 months free, or visit easyrecess.com/emcases for more details. Next up, we continue on the QI path with a doc who is new to EM cases, Dr. Matthew MacArthur. He's a soon-to-be EM resident who reached out to me on a particular topic of interest to him that he's been doing some QI work on, and there are many myths and misconceptions on this particular topic, and that topic is penicillin allergy. Here's Dr. Matt MacArthur.
Here's a topic that you're going to see on just about every shift for the rest of your career. Yet many of us know very little about it. The topic, penicillin allergy. Let's start with a case. You see an otherwise healthy 45-year-old male and make the diagnosis of community-acquired pneumonia. You decide to prescribe amoxicillin monotherapy. But just as you go to write the prescription, you notice the words, penicillin allergy on their chart. You ask the patient what happened when they had penicillin. They say they were around 7 years old and treated with amoxicillin for an ear infection, and they think they developed a rash of some sort with no recalled history of hospitalization or serious illness. So what do you do with this patient? Before we dive into penicillin allergy, we should also understand a bit about allergy cross-reactivity. Penicillins are beta-lactam antibiotics, a class of antibiotics which also includes cephalosporins, monobactams, and carbapenems. All of the beta-lactams work in the same way. They kill bacteria by blocking an enzyme that essentially helps build the cell wall. Allergy to beta-lactams is usually mediated by the drug's side chain structure, not the core beta-lactam ring. So risk of cross-reactivity is determined by the side chain. And risk can be evaluated in practice by referencing a cross-reactivity chart, which are found easily online. Most cephalosporins are at an extremely low risk of cross-reactivity in penicillin allergy, and this low risk of cross-reactivity is due to different side chain structures. Okay, that's really all you need to know about the pathophysiology of allergy cross-reactivity when you're prescribing beta-lactams. Now, back to penicillin allergy. About 10% of patients will report a penicillin allergy. Yet, about 90% of patients reporting a penicillin allergy can actually tolerate penicillins with no reaction. So why is there such a high prevalence of erroneous penicillin allergy? Well, there's many reasons. Infectious exanthems are common in pediatrics. And by some unfortunate quirk of the immune system, infectious exanthems can sometimes be triggered by the administration of an antibiotic. Likewise, infection-induced urticaria is another common pediatric complaint that frequently gets mislabeled as penicillin allergy. So oftentimes, it's actually the infection that is producing the rash, not the penicillin. In other cases, common drug side effects like GI upset or diarrhea are erroneously labeled as allergy and end up on the chart. And other times, patients will avoid penicillin based solely on a family history of penicillin allergy, even though it's not an atopic disorder and a family history doesn't confer increased risk. And even in the case of true penicillin allergy, most people will eventually grow out of their allergy, usually after 5 to 10 years. So why does any of this matter? Well, penicillin allergy labels are harmful to patients. A quick look at the literature makes this clear. Studies comparing patients labeled with penicillin allergy to those without show that patients labeled penicillin allergic receive less effective antibiotics for their infections, have higher risk of developing infections like MRSA and C. diff due to alternate antibiotic use, have more expensive treatments and longer lengths of stay in hospital, and even higher mortality. Over the last several years, protocols have been validated to safely de-label patients at low risk of allergy. One useful point-of-care de-labeling tool, DropTheLabel.ca, has been validated for both pediatric and adult patients. Another tool available on MDCalc, which estimates risk of penicillin allergy, is the PenFast score. F for less than 5 years since the reaction, A for anaphylaxis or angioedema, S for severe cutaneous symptoms, T for treatment required. The more points, the higher the risk of a positive allergy test to penicillin. As a general rule, adults more than 10 years from receiving penicillin who report isolated cutaneous symptoms without recollection of severe symptoms or the need for resuscitation can be safely prescribed penicillin or offered an oral challenge dose. Children who had delayed onset rashes occurring more than 2 hours after a dose and lasting more than 24 hours without systemic or severe symptoms can also be safely prescribed penicillin or offered a challenge dose. When you look at adult and pediatric validation studies, approximately 5% of patients given penicillin using oral challenge protocols had a minor skin reaction. No serious adverse reactions or anaphylaxis were reported. So these protocols are safe and the risk of anaphylaxis is extremely low, likely comparable to baseline population risk. Of course, risk of anaphylaxis or serious adverse drug reaction is never zero, even in patients with no reported allergy history. Let's go back to the case. You discussed the low risk of penicillin allergy, as well as the prevalence and harms of penicillin allergy label with your patient, and the patient agrees to try your first-line treatment of amoxicillin for their pneumonia. They understand that they have a roughly 5% risk of a minor skin rash, and if this happens, they can stop the medication and follow up with a doctor. They also know that with any medication, there's a very, very rare chance of severe drug reaction or anaphylaxis. Your patient ends up taking the treatment with no reaction, and they inform their future care providers to have the penicillin allergy label removed from their chart. Let's recap the takeaways from this quick hit. Number one, most reported penicillin allergies are erroneous. 90% of patients who report penicillin allergy can tolerate penicillins with no reaction. Number two, studies show that penicillin allergy labels are harmful to patients, leading to more expensive, less effective treatments, and also increasing risk of developing infections like MRSA and C. diff. Number three, protocols to safely de-label patients at low risk of allergy have been validated over the last several years, including dropthelabel.ca. The PenFast score is also helpful for estimating allergy risk when you're delabeling patients. All right, thanks everyone for listening. I hope you've learned a little something about penicillin allergy, and I hope you consider implementing this into your practice, because it's helpful both to your patients on an individual level, as well as to your community on an antimicrobial stewardship level.
Those are some great data details to prepare me for the next supposed penicillin allergy patient that I see. So thank you so much, Dr. MacArthur. All right, before we get to our last segment, which, by the way, is a really fascinating look at how EM physician personality might affect patient outcomes, I have just a couple of quick announcements. One is that ECG Cases himself, Dr. Jesse McLaren, still has a few spots open for the upcoming Resident Hearts ECG course in May and the Advanced Hearts ECG course in June. You can register quickly at heartsecgcourse.com. The other announcement I have involves bringing up your calendar on your phone or your computer to save the date, because the online International EM Cases Summit is coming up in November. November 21st, 22nd, 23rd. We've got a superlative lineup with all your favorite EM cases guest experts, symposiums on ED flow, rural EM and global EM, procedural tips and tricks, prize giveaways, pre-course options of the Hearts ECG course. I'm very excited for this one. Again, November 21st, 22nd, and 23rd. Put it in your calendar. More info at emcasessummit.com. There are a variety of factors that predict the outcomes of our patients. We know from QI that there are patient factors, systems factors, and physician factors. Now, when it comes to physician factors, we assume that our patient outcomes have something to do with our knowledge base, our experience, our intuition, maybe our training. And we discussed in our physician compassion episode that docs who are more compassionate tend to have better patient outcomes as well. There's probably a whole other variety of physician factors that may affect physician outcomes. Surprisingly, there's actually a paucity of literature on physician factors that affect outcomes in emergency medicine. Now, what if I told you that physician personality might predict patient outcomes? That the personality type of the physician may actually help predict how our patients do? So to answer that intriguing question, we have a new guest on EM Cases. Dr. Susan Liu is not an emergency physician, but a researcher. She's the Gerald Lyles Rising Star Professor of Management at the Krannert School of Management at Purdue University in Indiana. She's also an affiliated faculty of healthcare engineering at the Regenstrief Center for Healthcare Engineering. Welcome, Dr. Liu, to EM Cases.
Thank you.
Beautiful. So, how did you come up with the idea of studying the relationship between physician personality and patient outcomes in the first place?
We actually have been motivated by the growing interest in understanding the role of non-cognitive factors, such as personality traits. Research has shown that non-cognitive factors can influence human beings' behavior and performance. We are also motivated by the need to identify new ways to improve healthcare management. By exploring the relationship between physician personality traits and patient outcomes to identify new insights that could be used to optimize healthcare operations and management.
All right, interesting. So you're coming at it from the angle of improving patient outcomes, but also improving the administrative flow of patients and costs and all of that. This is the first time that physician personality and physician performance or patient outcomes has been studied rigorously. I understand that in your study, you used the Big Five or the five-factor model to look at personality traits. Now, personality traits are kind of hard to define, I would think. They're somewhat vague and subjective. What is the Big Five model of personality traits, and why did you use it for your study in particular?
The Big Five model of personality has been widely accepted framework that describes human personality traits based on five broad dimensions: openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, neuroticism. Each dimension represents a range of traits that are commonly used to describe individuals' personalities. For example, an openness doctor is very open-minded and they are capable to adopt new technology, new procedures, and capable to make decisions based on limited information. A conscientious type of doctor are very organized and very thorough and careful. They usually have a to-do list and they try to check out everything, make sure everything is great. And an extroversion doctor, you can imagine, who is very outgoing. An agreeableness doctor is very kind and always put themselves in other people's shoes and play a good agent for patients who would have better health outcomes and also save their money. And the last type is neuroticism. So a neuroticism type is either very confident or very unconfident. Sometimes they are very sensitive. So if we pay attention to the first letter of these five attributes, you can see it's O-C-E-A-N. Usually we also call it as ocean theory. So we use the ocean theory to extract physicians' personality traits from their personal statements posted on an online physician review platform. So this model was chosen because it is widely used in psychology research and it provides a comprehensive framework for understanding personality traits. It also has practical applications in healthcare research, as it has been shown to be relevant to healthcare providers' behavior and performance. By using the Big Five model, we were able to identify physicians' personality traits in a systematic manner, which helped us to explore the potential impact of these traits on clinical performance and patient outcomes.
All right. So just to review there, the Big Five or the ocean are openness. So that's being original, imaginative, creative, daring. They prefer variety over fixed routines. They're open to new technologies and they're more likely to pay special attention to new methodologies and advanced technology. And the conscientious is the hardworking, ambitious, thorough. They like planning things. They might like making lists of things. They're disciplined and systematic. The extroverted is sociable, fun-loving, affectionate, friendly, talkative. They derive energy from social activity. The agreeable are empathetic and kind and affectionate, and they like to engage in pro-social behaviors, things like volunteering, and they have sort of a warm attitude towards others. And it seems like so far all of these things would be great to have for an emergency physician. And then the last one is neuroticism, which is either you worry way too much and you're very insecure about things, or you're overconfident, which are generally bad things in emergency medicine. So out of those Big Five personality traits that are defined by the mnemonic ocean, which ones seem to predict patient outcomes in your study?
So we actually find three of the Big Five personality traits appeared to predict patient outcomes in the context of emergency department. So the first one is openness. We find that physicians with higher openness scores are associated with lower in-hospital mortality rates, lower lab test costs, and a shorter length of stay.
Wow. That's incredible. So again, I just want to highlight there. So physicians who score high on openness So they're the ones that are more likely to pay special attention to new methodologies and advanced technology. They prefer variety over fixed routines. They're sort of more imaginative and original and daring. When they score high on that, that actually correlates well with not only length of stay, but cost of lab tests, as well as mortality in hospital.
Correct.
Okay. Although this is correlational and not causative, it's still quite intriguing. Okay, so that's the openness. What are the two other findings?
So agreeable doctors were more likely to help patients save lab test costs due to their empathy, particularly for those low-income patients, because they tend to put themselves in patients' shoes.
Okay, yeah, that's very consistent with what we reviewed in our Physician Compassion episode with Barbara Tatum, with all the research that in the past it has showed that physicians who score higher on compassion spend less money on lab tests such as CT scans, etc. All right, so that's the agreeableness. And what was the third one?
The third one is conscientiousness. So we were very surprised to see the results. In general, actually, conscientiousness doctors are great doctors because they are very careful and thorough. However, in the emergent situation, physicians with a higher conscientiousness scores tended to incur more lab test costs and make patients wait longer to undergo principal procedures, mainly because they are very thorough. They have a to-do list, very organized. But in emergent situation, time is life.
Okay, so just to clarify there, so the doctors who are more conscientious incur higher lab costs, which makes sense. I mean, that's kind of intuitively obvious. What did you find in terms of conscientiousness and the patient outcomes? Was there any difference there?
There is no significant difference.
Okay, so if you're more conscientious, you're not going to improve patient outcomes, but you are going to increase lab costs and time to significant procedures.
Yes, waiting time, longer waiting time.
That's what you found. Okay, very interesting. Again, the three findings were that the doctors who scored high on openness actually had lower mortality rates in their patients. They had less laboratory costs and shorter lengths of stay, while the agreeable physicians had improved patient outcomes, similar to what we were saying in our Physician Compassion episode. And the conscientious physicians, not surprisingly, incurred more costs, but surprisingly, there was no difference in outcomes in the physicians who scored high on conscientiousness. All right, so putting this all together, what do you think ED docs and administrators should take away from your study?
I think there are three important implications from this study. First, this study suggests that physicians' personality traits, particularly openness, conscientiousness, and agreeableness, may affect patient outcomes in the ED setting. Therefore, physicians and administrators should be aware of these traits when training physicians. The second thing is that this study helped to leverage physician personality traits, which could improve healthcare in management. Another application could be the ED scheduling applications. If we can adjust ED scheduling based on physician's personality, it may be beneficial to those patients. Finally, we also think this study helped to reduce patients' medical costs. So if we can pair those physicians who are very agreeable to those patients who needed to save money, say, who are low-income patients, I think they are more likely to help patients in terms of the medical expenditure. These are the three major points.
Fascinating stuff. All right. Well, congratulations on your study, being what sounds like the first study to have really looked carefully at physician personality traits and patient outcomes, cost, and length of stay. Hopefully there'll be lots more research in this area. And who knows, I can envision a day in 10 years where we're incorporating physician personality into our schedules, into hiring, and into training for emergency medicine. Thanks so much for your insights.
Thank you so much, Anton.